From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. With advances in genetic research, scientists are learning more about our human ancestors. There are new insights into when we developed language and what it may have sounded like, and whether we're genetically inclined to kill each other. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Nicholas Wade, science reporter for the New York Times and author of Before the Dawn, Recovering the Lost History of Our Ancestors. Also, the film Music and Lyrics is out on DVD. We hear from director Mark Lawrence. And king of the surf guitar, Dick Dale. He's 70 years old this year, and a number of his classic recordings have been re-released. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. With advances in genetic research, scientists are learning more about our primate ancestors and how these creatures evolved physically and socially into the humans that came to populate the Earth. It now seems likely the Neanderthals of Europe were not our ancestors, but a separate species that may have battled with and been exterminated by the earliest humans. And there are new clues about when humans invented language and what it may have sounded like. Those are some of the topics explored by my guest, New York Times science writer Nicholas Wade. I spoke to him last year about his book, Before the Dawn, Recovering the Lost History of Our Ancestors. It's now out in paperback. When one considers the typical view of human evolution, we're all familiar with the encyclopedia book picture of the little tadpole in the water that becomes, you know, a fish, and then an amphibian, and then some kind of land-based creature, and then an ape, and then eventually we have the erect walking human beings. You present a very different picture of human evolution, and it appears that if you go back, say, 100,000 years ago, there was not one, but actually many different species of creatures walking around the Earth who looked something like us, right?
Well, that's right. There were ourselves. So we had attained our modern form by 100,000 years ago. We looked more or less as we do now, although our behavior was very different. And besides us, there were the Neanderthals, who are archaic humans who had escaped from Africa several hundred thousands of years before. They were in Europe. And there was also Homo erectus, another archaic species, that occupied most of Asia.
Now the Neanderthals have become part of common lore. They're often used to describe, you know, frat boy behavior, for an example. But they were an actual species that went extinct, like the dinosaurs, in fact, right? Tell us about these creatures who were, I don't know whether to call them humans or apes. The Neanderthals, those that occupied Europe, what did they look like? How did they behave? What kind of society did they have?
Well, they are definitely regarded as human. Their Latin name is Homo Neanderthalis. They were sort of recognizably human. I've heard it said that different Neanderthals sat down to you in a subway car. You would move to a different car. Whereas if a modern human 50,000 years ago sat down next to you, you might just move a few seats away. I think Neanderthals were very frightening to our ancestors. They were very heavily muscled. They were adapted to the cold of Europe, which was then in the grip of the last ice age. They had sophisticated weapons, and they probably bottled modern humans evolving in Africa up in that continent for many thousands of years, because we were no better than they militarily, and we could not fight our way out of the exits from Africa, the principal exits which were occupied by the Neanderthals.
The Neanderthals, you said, had weapons. What kind of weapons?
Well, we know they had stone-tipped spears. They almost certainly did not have bows and arrows. They probably had a fairly simple social organization. There's a fierce debate as to whether or not they had language. Very possibly they didn't. And it was the acquisition of language by our ancestors in Africa that enabled a higher level of social organization and the means to eventually overcome the Neanderthals.
But no modern human is descended from a Neanderthal. They became extinct, right?
That is correct. It's been a sort of long-standing debate as to whether or not Neanderthals sort of mated with modern humans, which was unresolved really until genetic testing. And then we were able to look at people were able to recover mitochondrial DNA from the type specimen of the Neanderthal, the first Neanderthal skull found in the Neander Valley in Germany. And that mitochondrial DNA proved to be so different from all modern human mitochondrial DNA that it showed that the Neanderthals had diverged away from our line a couple of hundred thousand years ago. This does not exclude the possibility that some Neanderthal genes, perhaps those that were useful in adapting to the cold, did get into the human line, but that has not been proved as yet. I think you can say there is a general rule that few, if any, Neanderthal genes survived in the modern human line, and the Neanderthals, in effect, did go extinct.
Now, there were, as we've said, several erect walking human-like species around the globe, and the ones which from which we are descended, I guess the anatomically modern humans, were in a part of Northeast Africa before they were able to escape the African continent and spread throughout the globe. But you, if I have this right, it's believed that they once shrank to as few as 5,000 people, and had that tribe not survived, the world today would not be populated with cities, farms, villages, anything, right?
Well, that is correct. And if there were farms and cities, it would be some other species occupying them, not ourselves. Of course, archaeologists have found no trace of this ancestral modern human population. So the estimate of their numbers comes purely from genetics. And by the amount of variation in the genome, you can make guesses as to population size. So the geneticists' guess has been far lower than you might have expected. At first they thought 10,000. Now their sort of ballpark figure is about 5,000 people. So it was from that tiny population that the whole world is descended.
And it was around 50,000 years ago that this small population of humans got out of Africa in, I guess, what one could call an exodus story. Right? What prompted them to move?
We don't know what prompted them to move. It's only a matter of speculation. But presumably there was an advantage in seeking novelty, in seeking new territory. It's probable that the ancestral human population was very... It may not have been a single population. It may have been divided into little warring groups, constantly at war with each other, as is often found, for example, in Australia or New Guinea or where tribal peoples occupy large areas. I think this is the sort of... is the nature of human existence, to split up into small groups like a tribe that is territorial, that defends its own territory and attacks its neighbors. So you can imagine if that were the case 50,000 years ago, it would be great to escape from the fight and go and find new unoccupied territory. So on that supposition, people would always have been trying to escape from Africa, but the odds were so stacked against them that only one small group succeeded.
Now, what about the early humans who did not join the migration out of Africa? Did some remain behind, and are they linguistically connected in any way to some of the tribes in Africa?
Yes, of course, some people did remain behind, and the human, although one can speak of an exodus from Africa, one shouldn't forget that much of the, in fact, most of the human family at that time remained within Africa. Now, our ancestral population was probably emerged somewhere in northeast Africa, maybe within the boundaries of modern Ethiopia, and so the exodus took a small portion of that population outside to the Arabian Peninsula and India, but the bulk of it would have remained in Ethiopia, but gradually started to spread southward and westward and to colonize the rest of Africa, just as their relatives were colonizing the rest of the world.
Now, people have spoken about the Klik-speaking people in parts of Africa. I mean, it's a language which is really very distinct from Bantu and some of the other languages. Is it believed that this might be farther up the linguistic tree and closer to the original language that our ancestors may have spoken tens of thousands of years ago?
Yes, there are intriguing signs that the Kliks, at least, are very ancient. And the main evidence for that is that the 30 or so Klik languages that survive today, most of them are spoken in southern Africa by the Sam, but there are a few. There are two that are spoken way north in Tanzania by people called the Hadza and the Sandawe, and these languages are completely different from the click language of South Africa in every respect except their clicks. So this was, for a long time, a great puzzle to linguists that the languages should be so different and apparently unrelated, until the geneticists came along and showed that there was the same difference in the genetics of the Hadza and the San people. And their genetics show that they diverged very early, at the earliest branches, on the earliest branches of the human tree that you can reconstruct from mitochondrial DNA.
So you have, in effect, these two groups of African living hundreds, I guess even thousands of miles apart, who are linguistically and genetically different from the people around them, but linguistically and genetically linked to each other, suggesting that they're survivors of this very, very early branch of the human tree.
Right? That is correct. And another reason to think that is that clicks, they're quite hard to do. You can do a single click, like when you say to a child, but it's very hard to do a double click, which several of these languages have. So it looks like once you have clicks, you can lose them, but it's very hard to see anyone sort of inventing a click from scratch. So if that's the case, if clicks have only been lost and not gained, then they must be of great antiquity.
Do we know when language began?
The best guess is that language began about 50,000 years ago, although it had probably been evolving for some time before that. But at least we think it reached its sort of modern form about that time.
And do we believe that all of the world's languages today are descended from a single root language?
This is a reasonable hypothesis, simply because if you assume that modern language was an identifying quality of that ancestral human population, which, as you mentioned, was only 5,000 people, and if they sort of lived reasonably close to each other, close enough to trade, and have other interactions, it's a reasonable assumption that they spoke a single language. Or even if there were sort of more than one language, that the others might have fallen extinct when humans entered that bottleneck of just 5,000 people.
New York Times science writer Nicholas Wade. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Speaking with New York Times science writer Nicholas Wade. His new book is called Before the Dawn, Recovering the Lost History of Our Ancestors. Now, I want to go a little bit farther back in prehistory. Before we were the anatomically modern humans were there, say 2 to 3 million years ago, some of our primate ancestors were much more like chimpanzees, and then something happened that caused some of these ape-like creatures living in trees to evolve in a direction that created us. And one of the things that seems may have been pivotal was the decision to eat meat, or the beginning of carnivorous practices as opposed to simply eating, vegetation. Why was that meaningful in the development of modern human anatomy?
Well, it was part of a complex of pressures of forcing our evolution, one of which was that our brain was getting larger, and probably the reason was that our societies were becoming more complex. The main reason why you need a larger brain is to interact with other members of your own species and learn how to survive in a primate, in an early human society. And this would have placed a constant demand each generation on people who had greater cognitive capacity, greater computing power, if you like. But the brain is a very greedy consumer of oxygen, and you need to have a more efficient way of getting your nutrition than chomping through mounds of vegetation, which is essentially what our primate cousins, the chimpanzees and the bonobos, do. So it seems to be that meat-eating and an increase in the size of the human cranium, as assessed by fossil skulls, and also the invention of the first fossil tools were all sort of bound together in an evolutionary nexus. And the first fossil tools, the older one complex, occurs at about the same time as we see the beginning of the expansion of the human cranium.
Now, we also know that a change critical to developing modern civilization was the invention of agriculture, because that allowed people to settle and build permanent communities and store food. But you write that our prehistorical ancestors had a major limitation to overcome before they could settle, and that was that they were really too aggressive to live together in villages. Do we seem to have a genetic predisposition to warfare?
I think it's reasonable to say that we do have a genetic predisposition to warfare. It's not the controlling part of our nature, but it's always there beneath the surface. But it's counterbalanced by many other tendencies, including the more conciliatory instincts of trade and exchange and reciprocity. But I think it is connected with the strange fact you mentioned that it took us so long to settle down. We left Africa 50,000 years ago, but there's no sign of human settlements until 15,000 years ago. So what was happening during those 35,000 years? Why did it take us so long to realize that there are great advantages in settling down in one place rather than living as hunters and gatherers with no shelter or fixed abode? So it's reasonable to assume that, well, we didn't settle down because we were too fierce and aggressive to do so. If you settle down, you make yourself a sitting target for anyone who's on the move. Your best defense is to keep moving. So maybe it required another evolutionary change in our behavior, almost as significant as the earlier one that led to the perfection of language 50,000 years ago. Maybe it took another 35,000 years ago for us to develop a more conciliatory version of human behavior that allowed us to settle down in fixed groups large enough to resist attack and survive.
Now, one of the interesting differences between us and our primate relatives is that while most animals have fur or hair throughout their body, we have relatively little hair except for this spot on the top of our head, which grows regularly and causes us to kind of cut it and groom it and shape it in modern times. Do we know why we began to grow this hair on our heads, when that might have occurred?
We don't know for sure. There's a gene that seems to be involved in controlling the hair cycle and hence the length of hair, which is changed in humans compared to its chimpanzee version. And this gene seems to have changed about 100,000 years ago. So given the enormous social importance of hair in human society as a sort of signaling system of caste and status and emotional state, and given the attention that people all around the world still pay to their hair, you can imagine that it evolved because it did something useful for its owners to have continually growing hair. So I see it as yet another social adaptation we made to the increasing complexity of our societies.
What advantage would it give someone to have continually growing head hair?
Well, presumably because you could signal information with it, and this information was somehow of value in constructing your society and making it more cohesive. It's easy to sort of spin just so stories. We don't exactly know what advantage it was that made this gene become widespread. We can simply observe the gene did become widespread. So presumably it was for some evolutionary reason which we can only speculate about.
Well, and you know, chimpanzees love to groom each other, and I wonder if people grooming their hairs and grooming each other's hair had some interaction with a, you know, signaled a greater level of social interaction.
Oh, well, it may well have done. I mean, grooming is very important in primate societies, and you spend a great deal of time grooming people who are important to you. If you're trying to rise to the top of the male chimp hierarchy, you need to spend a lot of time grooming your social superiors so as to form alliances that may enable you to overthrow them at one time. So it may well be that this was the basis of interaction. I don't know if humans groomed each other as much as other primates do. They have, of course, less hair. One of the theories of the origin of language is that when you could speak to someone, you could perform the grooming function much more efficiently in far less time. And that the need to groom all other members of a primate community was a constraint that keeps monkey communities at about sort of 50 individuals. They never grow more than that. Humans sort of broke that constraint, and maybe it was in part because they had switched from grooming behavior to language as a grooming substitute.
Well, Nicholas Wade, thanks so much for speaking with us.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
New York Times science writer Nicholas Wade. His book, Before the Dawn, is now out in paperback. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Villette, Charlotte Bronte's last novel, in stores and online at bn.com. From the Pew Charitable Trusts, helping states protect public safety, hold offenders accountable, and control the cost of corrections at pewpublicsafety.org. And from Fox Searchlight, presenting Once, the tale of two kindred spirits making music and finding romance on the bustling streets of Dublin, now playing in select theaters. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
That's the sound of none other, Dick Dale, king of the surf guitar. Coming up, we'll hear from him. A number of his early recordings have been re-released. Also, the film Music and Lyrics, about a washed-up 80s music writer trying to revive his career, is now out on DVD. We'll talk with director Mark Lawrence. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. Our guest Mark Lawrence wrote and directed the movie Music and Lyrics, which has just come out on DVD. Music and Lyrics is filled with in-jokes about 80s pop. The film stars Hugh Grant as a washed-up 80s pop star who's reduced to performing at amusement parks, and then an opportunity comes his way. A Britney Spears-type teen star, who was his fan as a child, asks him to write a song for her. If she likes it, she'll record it and debut it in a duet with him. He's good at writing melodies, but doesn't write lyrics. In the process of searching for a lyricist, he realizes the woman who's just started taking care of his plants seems to have a way with words. So he recruits her to collaborate on the song. She's played by Drew Barrymore. Several of the songs in the film were written by Adam Schlesinger of the band Fountains of Wayne. In this scene from Music and Lyrics, Hugh Grant and Drew Barrymore are in his apartment trying to write the song.
And I don't think those chords are right. It has to sound different than the verse.
What kind of different did you have in mind?
I don't know, something sadder, you know? And I still don't like my line about places in my mind.
It's fine.
Fine isn't good.
We only have time for fine. I tell you what, look, you will change your line about places in my mind if I can keep the chord sequence into the bridge, yeah?
This isn't a negotiation. It's either right or wrong, inspired or insipid.
I tell you what it is, it's 4 a.m. and we're not writing the last movement of the Jupiter Symphony. It's a song for someone whose last hit was called Welcome to Booty Town. Please get back to work.
Still don't like it.
Whoa.
And it's entering Booty Town. Right.
Terry spoke to Mark Lawrence earlier this year when Music and Lyrics was in theaters.
There's a song called Pop Goes My Heart that Hugh Grant's band in the movie Pop records. And like that's their big hit from the 80s, mm-hmm. Pop Goes My Heart. So you had to get somebody to like write this song. So who did you choose for Pop Goes My Heart?
Pop Goes My Heart was written by Andrew Wyatt and Alana Vincente, I believe is the pronunciation of her last name. And Andrew is just a brilliantly talented songwriter and musician. And Andrew wrote not only Pop Goes My Heart, but pretty much all of these songs for the Britney Spears-type character in the film. And Andrew actually has quite a bit of experience writing for and producing songs for Britney Spears and Christina Aguilera and that group of people.
Well, let's play the song, and then I'll ask you to describe what the video is like. So here's Pop Goes My Heart from the soundtrack of Music and Lyrics. Okay, so we just heard the song that was written for the 80s band in Music and Lyrics, in which Hugh Grant plays a songwriter. And there's a great video. My guest Mark Lawrence directed the movie. And Mark, there's a great video that opens the movie.
Right.
It's a great 80s video for this song. So I imagine like you conceived and shot the video yourself.
I did. Once Andrew had written the song, I used that as the kickoff point for how we were going to construct the video, and I went back and watched a lot of those 80s videos, and a lot of them had performance aspects to them. You know, you see the band playing and jumping around, and then a lot of them also had acting, if you can call it that, storylines to them, which were always just unbelievably over the top, with everyone over-emoting and shaking their heads and just a great theater of bad acting. And so I thought it would be nice to combine those two. So it came up with that little storyline working off of the lyrics, where Hugh's heart is broken because his girl has left him, and it's so broken that he winds up in the hospital, and then he has a dream about the girl who left him, and then the sexy nurse who revives him reinstills his faith in love, and he bounces back off the gurney, and it's taken from a Chekhov short story, and
and needless to say, there's lots of quick edits, and there's a like black and white checkerboard background.
Yes.
Through a lot of it. So what videos did you study for this, and what were certain things where you thought, like, I've got to do my version of that?
Well, Terry, I guess I can let you in on this secret, which is if anyone goes and decides to watch the Wham video, Wake Me Up Before You Go-Go, you will certainly notice some similarities. That if there was a template for it, that was it. And partially because the idea for Hugh's story mirrored to me kind of a George Michael, Andrew Ridgely story where there were two guys in a band and one went on to become a household name and a huge star and the other one was more likely to be the subject of a Where Are They Now show. So that led us to Wham. And then the feeling of the band of pop, I thought, should be closer to, a teeny bopper, sort of a Beatles in the Mop Top era rather than anything darker. So I watched all the Wham videos. I watched a bunch of the Duran Duran videos and Flock of Seagulls.
The dialogue in Music and Lyrics is really funny. Lots of witty retorts and caustic asides from you, Grant. You're obviously good at writing this kind of humor. Can you draw on this in real life? Like, can you quip in real life?
Well, I try to do this with my wife, but it requires me writing the setups for her, and she's often not amenable to that. If she'll do the right setup, I can be phenomenally witty. Yeah, I can. You know, the first thing that I did professionally was writing on a sitcom, and it was called Family Ties. And when I showed up there, and this was shot out in L.A., I was 24 years old, and I had just dropped out of law school. And I'd never written with anyone else. I had just written a few scripts and was lucky enough to have them like it and fly me out there. And suddenly I was sitting at a table in L.A. at Paramount Studios with five other really talented, really clever, really smart writers. And my first day there, you know, we would all sit around a table together and work on the script, which involved taking the script that we had on the stage that week and improving it. And I sat there, and people were so fast and so funny and so quick. And I remember calling Linda, was not my wife yet, but we were already going out, and calling her and saying, I don't think I'm going to be able to do this. It's just too fast. And but, you know, I stayed on the show, and they were nice enough to keep me on the show. And very quickly, I sort of got into that rhythm, and it became one of my favorite things to do. And TV training, and I was at that show writing and producing it for 5 years, and that kind of training is really, really invaluable, I think, when you're doing a comedy.
Now you got started in your writing career writing for Family Ties, and that happened because you sent them a spec script. What was that script that you sent?
I had, actually, the first script I wrote was called The World's Most Famous House, and it was based on my experiences at college, living in an off-campus house with some people. And I sent that script out. I got a book called The Writer's Market, which I believe is still published now, and it listed all the agents that you could send a script to, all the WGA-approved agents. And, you know, I typed my script and I copied it. This was sort of before computer. This was 1983, I guess. I didn't have a computer. And I put them, I guess, about 50 or 60 of them in envelopes and sent them out to pretty much every agent in that book. And they all came back, not even rejected, just unread, except for two. One of them was from a lady named Marcia Amsterdam, who is still lives here in Manhattan, and she was a literary agent, mostly concentrating on books, and she said, you know, I read this and I like it, come on up and talk, and she became my first agent, and she said, what would you like to do? And I said, I'd like to write for movies and television. She said, let's start with TV because the scripts are shorter and it's faster, and I had not watched television in quite a while at college or whatever sitcoms were on, so I got a copy of TV Guide and I circled all the sitcoms that were on that year, and I on a little black and white television I started watching them, and the two that struck me were Cheers and Family Ties, and I particularly was attracted to the character that Michael Fox was playing on Family Ties, so I went and wrote a script and she sent it out and they called and they flew me out, and then suddenly I was there. And the only other script that was read of those 50 or 60 that I sent out was by a man named Jack Rollins, who, of course, was Woody Allen's producer. not just Woody Allen, but, you know, Billy Crystal and David Letterman. He said, come on up, I want to talk to you. And I went up to his office on 57th Street, sat in this room surrounded by these huge pictures of Woody Allen. Just I had run out from the job I was in at the time on my lunch hour. And he walked in carrying two pastrami sandwiches, and he said, one of these is for you. And he sat down, and we just started talking. We must have talked for two and a half hours. And it was everything you wanted show business to be. This was a man who just loved comedy writing because he loved it. And he answered all my questions about Woody Allen and about comedy writing. And at the end of it, he said, take a look at this script. I think this is the kind of movie that you could write. And it was a movie that he had just produced, and it was called Arthur. And it was the first screenplay I had ever seen in my life when I took that and ran out of the office. And it was probably still the most thrilling meeting I ever had in show business. So those are the two people who responded to the script.
Director Mark Lawrence speaking with Terry earlier this year. His film Music and Lyrics is now out on DVD. Coming up, music that says summer. This is Fresh Air. It's almost summer. The surf music sound of the 60s was created by our guest guitarist Dick Dale. He never had any top 40 hits himself, but his twangy staccato sound and fast, flashy picking inspired generations of rock guitarists. And his band, the Deltones, was the focus of the music scene that grew up around the California surf culture of the late 50s and early 60s. Dale played in the films Beach Party and Muscle Beach Party and the 1987 send-up Back to the Beach. He's a man of many interesting hobbies, among them raising exotic animals, including lions, tigers, and leopards. Dale is 70 now, but he's still performing. His career got a second wind in 1994 when Quentin Tarantino featured his work in the film Pulp Fiction. He's on stage in Cape Cod this weekend, and four of his classic albums have been re-released by Sundazed Records. Terry spoke to Dick Dale in 1993 and asked him about his early musical influences.
I was raised actually listening to the big band era, you know, like Guy Lombardo, Harry James, and the first person that I really listened to was Gene Krupa on drums, and that's where I get this heavy staccato drumming effect on playing, like Mick Fleetwood of Fleetwood Mac once said to me, watching me, he said, my God, he says, you're the most percussive guitarist I've ever seen in my life. You look like you're playing drums.
Some of the surf music stars didn't really surf, most notably the Beach Boys. But you did. You actually did surf. Is there a connection between the sounds that you'd hear surfing and the kind of music you were playing?
Yes. The waves did create my feelings of that sound, that ticka-ticka-ticka-ticka-ticka. It was like the lip of a wave coming over the top of my head. I'd stick my finger in the wall and get my ear up as close as I could, getting in a tube, or then doing a bottom turn and missing it and getting sucked up over the top and being just crunched right through your board. And in those days, we used the big 10-footers, you know.
Did the sound of the ocean make you want to get that loud, amplified sound that you wanted?
Yeah, it's a combination of the ocean and the roar of my tigers and lions, and just putting it all together, that force. And the ocean just has the two sounds. It has the one that comes over the top of your head. It's a lacy sound. And then it has that bottom rumbling sound. And then it has that wipeout sound. And with my big 60-gauge strings, like most guitar players are using 7s and 8s and 9s, the slinkies, you know, and 10s, my thinnest string is a 14 unwound. And then I use two 18 unwounds for my second and third string, and then my fourth string I use a 38 wound, and my fifth I use a 48, and then I use a 58 or a 60, whichever ones I can get.
So this is like really thick strings you're using, and that gives it a deeper sound?
Yeah, it gives it a big, Joel Sullivan calls them bridge cables. He gives you a real, real fat, thick, thick sound, along with the combination of the what goes into this amplifier and the guitar and the speaker. It's a combination of everything. But playing them is very hard. It's very painful because it's like taking your finger and going up and down, you know, the sidewalk with it. And that's why when I make faces, everybody goes, "Oh man, you make the neatest faces." I go, "That's pain. That's not."
Now, what about the picking style that you developed?
The picking came from my parents, my father's side of the family. His grandparents, his mother and father were born in Beirut, Lebanon. And my mother's side of the family were born in Poland. So I was subject to the musical styles of both countries. But when I had that influence of that Arabic music, when I came to California, a kid asked me, he said, "Can you play on one string?" Because I was playing what I called rockabilly. And I developed a rockatuck style of strumming on the guitar because I didn't have a whole band. So I would go tinkata, 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 tinkata. So now, when I did that, this little boy, he was probably about 10, and at my first show at the Rendezvous Ballroom in Balboa, that's when it opened up. We had like 17 surfers and the kids I was surfing with. And he says, "Can you play on one string?" And I didn't know what to do. And I says, "Well, come back tomorrow night and I'll have something for you," just to get rid of them. And then when I went home, I says, "Oh my God, I'm going to get caught. I'm going to be found out that I'm a fake, you know, that I can't play on one string or something." And I thought, and I says, "Mizzaloo." And Mizzaloo was played very slowly. I went and quadrupled the sound. I went tick-a-tick-a-tick-a-tick-a-tick because I wanted it a machine gun staccato picking style, which is very difficult to play, because you have to keep your meter properly. And then as a result, you break stainless steel strings and you melt picks down, two or three of them in a song, they melt. And that's why I have a special pick holder that I reach down and I throw one out when I play and I pick one up and I continue melting. But that's how I get that sound. It's like a machine gun style, picking style.
Well, let's hear your original recording of Mizzaloo, which you made back in 1962.
Yeah, I think the original people that did it are probably turning over in their grave when they heard it the way I play it.
The scene like on the beach when you started surfing and playing?
We would go down to the beach at 5 o'clock in the morning to get the early glass off and build a fire to keep warm. We never had wetsuits at that time, so we froze in the water. Our legs would turn blue. We'd beat on our legs to stop the pain, and we just hoped that the next wave, waiting for the next wave, and you just beat on our thighs, you know, just to keep the pain from going away. It was just that everybody had a camaraderie about them. And basically in California, everyone that went to a Dick Dale dance, you know, we all met at the beach and we would all surf. And we'd just surf all day, come out of the water, break and have a sandwich and go back in and surf to the evening glass offs. And it was just a cleanliness, you know. Everybody was safe. Everybody could walk the beaches safe.
Surf guitarist Dick Dale speaking with Terry Gross in 1993. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We'll be right back. Let's get back to Terry's 1993 interview with king of the surf guitar, Dick Dale.
When you started playing, you wanted a really loud sound, and you couldn't get it loud enough. And you knew Leo Fender, the guitar maker, and what, you worked together to get an amplifier that would give you the volume you wanted?
Well, what happened was it wasn't as much as volume. What it was a quality of sound. I wanted to get a fat, thick, deep sound that was very fat, sounding like a big floor tom, a tom-tom. And because once again, listening to the Gene Krupa drumming, and when we never mic'd our amplifiers, we never had mics in front of amplifiers, so the amplifier had to sound thick and pure on its own merit. And with Leo making just amplifiers that are only 10-inch speakers, you cannot get a sound out of a 10-inch speaker that gives you a fat, thick sound. So when Leo Fender would call me to come to his factory, he said, "Dick, I've got the sound. I'd go up there and I'd play this amplifier that he'd have, and it would be really loud, you know, and really powerful. And I go, "Wow, that's sounds great." But then when I took it to the Rendezvous Ballroom and got it on the stage, and there's 4,000 people out there, all of a sudden their clothes would suck up the sound and suck up the thickness and the bassness of this sound, and I wouldn't have any more power or any more depth of sound. So I kept trying to tell Leo that, and we kept on making all these adjustments with output transformers, with speakers, and that's how I blew up over 48 speakers and amplifiers. They'd catch on fire. The speakers would freeze. The speakers would tear from the coils. We went to Lansing Company and said, "Listen, we need a beefier speaker that'll handle the big bass strings, that'll handle this output transformer." And then Leo finally came to, and Freddie Travers came to the Rendezvous, stood in the middle of 4,000 people to watch what I was doing, and they looked at each other and they said, "Now I know what Dick's trying to tell me." So he went back to the drawing board, came up and invented the Dick Dale Showman amplifier and the dual Showman amplifier with the 15-inch Lansing speaker. That was the end result of the sound, and along with the creations that we did on the Stratocaster guitar, making it a real thick body, because the thicker the wood, the more pure the sound.
Right. Let me play one of your early records. This dates back to 1962. It's Surf Beat. You want to say something about the record? And, you know, right before we started the interview, you told me you hate your early records. Do you hate this record?
Well, I don't hate the song. No, I don't hate the song. I hate the way it was recorded, because it just wasn't big and fat like I play. And no one's ever been able to capture that. In high tone, this is the first time in my life that I ever consented to coming in, like 30 years of recording. You know, I come back from 30 years or something, and they said, "Dick, do what you want." And this is the first time in my life I ever had an engineer wanting to please and say, "Hey, don't worry about the time being spent," like high tone said. "Don't worry about it. We're going to put everything into how long it takes to get you happy, to get that sound." And the end result was, no fancy overdubbing. Ry Cooter was asked by Scotty. He said, "How do I record Dick Dale?" And Ry Cooter said, "Don't infect Dick Dale's brain with anything going on today, because he don't know what's going on today. He's up in the mountain someplace, and he could care less. Just plug him in, turn the tape recorder on, and let him go, and don't let the needles go into the red, and just record it." And that's exactly what we did. And it was nothing but just creativity right from beginning to end.
So you don't like the way you were recorded on the early records?
No, it did not have, it sounded too tinny, and I was ashamed to play them to anybody.
You were ashamed to play your own records?
I never played my own records. I never even kept them in the house. Because I listened to Hank Williams instead.
Well, okay, so I'm going to play it.
Does that sound strange?
Well, yeah. But I'll be the one to play. I'll play your 1962 recording of Surf Beat. That's Dick Dale recorded in 1962. It's interesting. I mean, here you are, like Mr. Surf Guitar and everything. You're living in the desert. Pretty paradoxical. What's it like for you to live so far from the ocean?
Well, you know, out of sight, out of mind. And the thing lies is I almost got squished away from the ocean because the population is just, it's just like somebody built a shoebox and put a bunch of mice in it, and the mice kept growing and growing, and the shoebox stays the same. So it's so sad that the population is just exploding and everyone's running around with their heads chopped off or something. So I wanted peace. So I went up to the high desert, and if I don't speak, I can hear my ears ring. And it's so wonderful up there. It's like living in a tomb. And it just gives you another 20 years to your life because it's so beautiful with the desert creatures. And it's a place to raise my 17-month-old son. And it's just peaceful, so peaceful.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry. I can't wait to get back and out there and do the whole thing.
King of the Surf guitar Dick Dale speaking with Terry Gross in 1993. 4 of his classic albums have been re-released. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for NPR comes from Bantam Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Washington's Spies, the story of America's first spy ring by Alexander Rose. From Endless Pools, swimming machines designed for exercise, fitness, and fun. DVD at 888-882-SWIM or endlesspool.com. And from the Criterion Collection, presenting a 2-DVD special edition of The Third Man, starring Orson Welles. In stores now at Criterion.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air for Memorial Day, we hear about the soldiers who fight in Iraq. Journalist Martha Raddatz tells us about the Battle of Sadr City, when the 1st Cavalry faced Iraqi insurgents for the first time. And Battalion Sergeant Richard Jaddick tells us about treating the wounded during the Battle of Fallujah. Join us for the next Fresh Air.